Hey guys, welcome back to the Sisyphus 55 podcast. Today I'm joined with Benjamin Cavalazze, who is a PhD student studying psychology. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. Hey everybody. My name is Benji Cavalazze. I just finished my third year in grad school. I'm at the University of California, Irvine. And I study psychological science, but basically my focus is ways to use the internet to improve people's well-being.
Okay, so I think one of the things that we'll immediately have maybe like a disagreement or have some sort of like a controversy over is I think most people would blame the internet for poor psychological well-being. So I'm kind of curious if you could expand on your idea about how the internet could possibly help.
Yeah, I think this is definitely the reaction that I get like every single time that I bring up what I study, because yeah, people just mentioned that the internet is making mental health, you know, worse off. But so I think that I'm an optimist, just being that I probably, like you, just grew up spending a lot of time on the internet and online communities, and just saw how those can be spaces that are like validating and also sources of all kinds of information. And then I think it's also important to note that like the scientific evidence has not really shown that using the internet in any way, like in general on average, has a negative impact on well-being or mental health. So yeah, I'm an optimist in the sense that I feel like there are ways that the internet can be used to improve well-being. Clearly, it has downside, like people have negative experiences, but I think it's kind of similar to like real life social life, where people have positive experiences and negative experiences, but you wouldn't tell someone to just like stay away from social life in general. You wouldn't tell a kid to like not go to school because they might have negative experiences. So that's my perspective. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I do find that interesting because I'm definitely not like an absolutist when it comes to that argument. I am like skeptical, but because I do remember there were some studies we looked at in class that they looked at this, and I forget exactly what the theories were called, but it was like the idealized self hypothesis versus like the real self hypothesis. And it was basically whether social media is actually a good representation of who you are versus like it being like a false or like enhanced idea of who you are. And it seems to be a better indicator of who you are. Like AI programs could go into a person's social media platform and just based off of like how they're talking on their like news feed and what they're saying, they can actually create a more accurate personality profile than family and friends of the same person. And so I think in that regard, you definitely have a point where social media seems to be more like a reflection of reality than a kind of gross, kind of deformed version of it, in some aspects. And I remember that all of these studies had to do with Facebook specifically, and one of the other issues with the reason why they think that they're having a lot of like flaws with these studies is social media platforms differ so much. It's hard to like generalize one study about Facebook to one study about Twitter or ideas about TikTok or Instagram. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's very true, and a problem with social media research that the platforms are always changing. And I guess what we would really want is to find some like core elements of like across different platforms, like, I don't know, like maybe a news feed like interacts with the human mind in this given way, like it provides this kind of a like reward or cost. But that's kind of hard to do because everything in like an online social experience matters, like all the different user experience, like the color and the way that it scrolls, it just totally affects the like way that someone like experiences that, and that's actually really important. So it's tough to get those like constant things. And so like people have tried to do this with like mental health intervention research, where you have like one platform and then build different kind of interventions on that online platform. But like, again, it ends up being hard because if you make it too standard, it'll be like out of date in 2 years. So yeah, you just brought up a relevant point.
Yeah, and I maybe one way I've kind of grouped two social media, like the differences between social media platforms, if you can do two broad categories, is that there's platforms that are very active, where they require active engagement and like you have to do a lot of stuff, and then there's ones that are very like passive and it's more just kind of scrolling and watching, and there's obviously like overlap, but like YouTube, for example, for most of the population is going to be like a passive thing. Most people watch it. I spend most of my time when it comes to YouTube watching YouTube videos than making them, and I'm probably someone that's more like actively involved in the platform, whereas something like and maybe it goes down to maybe personality, but something more like Facebook or Instagram, where it's like you're liking things, you kind of know the people in the community a little bit more, and you could of course have different personality profiles and how you approach these platforms. Some people are more passive, some people are more active, but I'm wondering if you think that's maybe a useful categorization.
Gosh, yeah, you brought up the active passive difference in when we were emailing, and I sent you back this like more recent meta-analysis of like the active versus passive like hypothesis that like if you use the internet in an active way, like, you know, you're reaching out and in social ways, or you're creating content or like sharing content, that's like better for you than using it in a passive way where you're just kind of lurking. But I'm not sure that that's been borne out. So basically the conclusion of this meta-analysis was that that hypothesis was not supported, maybe because it's just a little bit too like crude and trying to like make things too simple. I can imagine there are a lot of ways that using the internet in an active way can be bad. Like, for example, I know Twitch streamers all the time talk about like struggling with using that platform. It's like extremely active. They're constantly in like a social interaction with their viewers, but it can be really rough on their mental well-being. So I think things are just really too nuanced to make those broad generalizations. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I agree. Like, I feel like a lot of the studies I look at, it's like the minute they think they found something that's like, oh, social media is a symptom of depression or social media is a cause of depression, it's like immediately after there's like a follow-up study that's like, maybe it's not that. And it's like really hard to form like a solid opinion because like the nature of the topic itself is ever changing. And I think I'm trying to like back it up just a little bit before we even talk about which one's better or worse, but just trying to categorize. I think what we were talking about was the kind of like what you're trying to get across is that most of the studies on social media, probably because of the ever-changing nature of the topic itself, very difficult to make generalizations. And every time I see studies on social media where it says that social media is a symptom of, like, social media use is a symptom of depression, or depression is a symptom of social media use, there's constant follow-up studies that seem to conflict with each other. And so it makes sense, like, the active passive argument isn't a very like settled argument. It is intuitive, I think, for a lot of people, so I think a lot of people run with it. But I think I'm trying to like back up just a little bit, where I'm not even talking about which one's better to use. I'm just talking about how could we better categorize these very broad social media platforms that are so different, that maybe some of them involve more active engagement, some of them involve more passive engagement. I think that's kind of what I was trying to get to. And I'm wondering if you think that that's just like a useful categorization, or if you have other ideas of how to categorize social media.
Yeah. Okay. Now I understand what you're saying. I guess it's still tricky, and I haven't seen people trying to do those categorizations, like breaking it down to the bare bones, like what is this platform about? Maybe part of that is that people use social platforms in so many different ways. Like, people use Snapchat for like all kinds of different stuff. It's like communication. It's just browsing, you know, in a passive way. It can be like a source of support. You know, kids have their like streaks going on for weeks and weeks. So it's all just like really complicated to me, because these are like social spaces and social life is always so complex. But I definitely like feel what you're saying about like the literature being complicated. It really does seem like every other study just like cancels out the last one, and yet people are making these bold claims. Like, so Jonathan Haidt is like, you know, he's really been a champion of this issue of like increasing mental health issues and pinning that on social media. But when you look at the like research studies, that's like a very highly debated issue still. And it really gets down to these like kind of nitty gritty statistical choices that different labs make, and they come up to different conclusions a bit based off that. So personally, I'm like lost with this whole issue because I don't know what to do with all of that statistical stuff. But yeah, it would be great to figure out, but it's been tricky so far. And maybe like people say that if social media companies would share more data, that would make it, you know, more easy to actually figure out those like more fundamental questions.
Yeah, that is very interesting. And I think that that kind of almost expands to like the more like political argument about social media, that is there's large companies using this data and they're selling it for various different means that can kind of affect society at large. And I don't know how much that maybe goes into the mental health aspect, but I definitely think it maybe adds another potential. If you're already not a proponent of social media usage, it definitely adds to the sort of negative stigma surrounding its use. But I guess our conversation more centers on social media usage as it affects the individual and their well-being. And yeah, I guess I'm a little bit curious, because it's one thing to research like this sort of topic and try to just out of curiosity's sake figure out what's going on, but to try to develop an intervention on a not entirely like settled area, I'm wondering how you go about doing that, because like you said, there's a lot of statistical issues, there's knowledge blockades in the way that companies don't release this sort of data. I'm curious about kind of the methodology.
Gotcha. So you're referring to like what I'm planning for my dissertation?
Mm-hmm. Just give like a brief of just kind of the general idea also.
Yeah, sure. Okay, I'll try. So the main issue that I want to target with the work is loneliness. So the idea is to make internet interventions for loneliness that are really short, like maybe 20 to 30 minutes, that someone can just like share, and then someone can do this intervention and it'll create some kind of like insight or spark of motivation in order for someone to like take that start and then go further working on, you know, maybe social skills or kind of challenging some of the negative thoughts about social interactions that they might have. So that's what I have planned for my dissertation. I'm breaking it down into different studies looking at like how do you actually build a internet intervention for loneliness in a way that is not only like helpful in that it would like reduce symptoms of loneliness at like a 2-week follow-up after you do it, but also engaging, meaning that people like actually enjoy it, are into it, and will be willing to like share it with their friends and just like, you know, find it a cool experience. And that aspect of engagement is something that I'm really interested in, because it's really been a surprisingly hard challenge to overcome with all of this like excitement about mental health apps. The major barrier has been that people just don't get that engaged. Like, they kind of tend to use it for like 5-10 minutes, check out a mental health app, check out the intervention, and then I don't know what happens. Like, they sort of get bored. I mean, personally, it's been my experience when I download a mental health app and check it out that I tend to get bored, and I feel like I could probably get something, you know, more interesting or more like thorough or like suited to me if I just look on YouTube or like Google it or just type in the problem, you know, Reddit, as the meme goes. Yeah.
You feel like there's kind of like an impersonal element to mental health apps right now, where it's just kind of trying to be a catch-all for like mental health issues, and it's not like specifically addressing like the individual's needs.
Yeah, maybe, or maybe it's just like not for me, you know, like when I think about all the different kinds of stuff online, like, you know, TV shows, YouTube videos, everything is kind of tailored to a certain audience. You know what I mean? Like, so what appeals to, like, a 15-year-old girl who is, like, going through depression might not appeal to me, because we just have, like, totally different, you know, aesthetics and things that we're into. And I think that might be the reason that, like, mental health apps, you know, don't, like, really hit right for a lot of people.
So do you think, like, this intervention would kind of solve that problem and make it more personalized, or more like it would keep people's attention longer than like 10-15 minutes?
Okay, yeah, so there's two like parts to the study. The first one is just to make a standard like single session intervention that is like other ones that I've been done before, where it's typically like text-based and uses some simple images. So it's just like simple kind of shares ideas from cognitive behavioral therapy, kind of just like, you know, a therapy-based intervention. And I hope that'll be helpful. But then so the second part is to try and make it more personalized and tailored. And my strategy for doing that is to pull from the internet, pulling from what I call popular online content, which means like YouTube videos, TikToks, Instagram, infographics, in order, ones that are relevant somehow to mental health. Like, meaning that I ask maybe 100 people to tell me what is some popular online content that would make you feel better when you're struggling with loneliness, for example, or might give you some insights, and then create a library of this popular online content for all different kinds of people. So that's like my strategy. I haven't tested it yet. I don't know if it'll work, but that's the idea, is to like pull from the like diverse, you know, library of wisdom that is the internet.
Okay, and I guess the way that I think when you first approached me, how I was conceptualizing this intervention was that it was like a, you're kind of numbing the pain of loneliness with lots of content, but it sounds more like you are trying to offer, it's like a filter for offering like legitimate resources on the internet, which is like basically the largest library of knowledge we have, so that they can, like, whoever is feeling lonely can like then apply this. So it's less of like a band-aid or something trying to like numb the pain at all, and it's more of like trying to address the root cause of the issue and trying to like kind of give people like advice and, like you said, like wisdom. Is that correct?
Yeah, totally. I think you said it really well. Like, so my, I guess, like, framework for this is that of, like, the insight moment, where someone can experience an insight by encountering some kind of, like, piece of information or some awe-inspiring experience. And then once they have that insight moment, like, everything kind of comes together for them. So they have an understanding of, like, what their problem is. And they also have the motivation to, like, put in the effort that is required to overcome that problem. In this case, like a mental health problem, it always takes a lot of hard work. So it's definitely not about numbing. It's about trying to find like what is the right insight for the right person. And what I was saying or trying to say earlier is that people are gonna find those insights in different ways. And it's kind of hard to predict who's gonna find the right insights. Like you have to give the user some choice and like freedom of exploration. And I think that kind of pulls from like my own experiences. Like I said, like just growing up, spending a lot of time in online communities, like exploring, trying to find new answers. And so the reason that I reached out to you is because I feel like that's something that your like videos on your YouTube channel are about. It's like trying to share these different perspectives towards like the good life. And yeah, so that's where I'm coming from there. Does it make sense?
Yeah, no, it's actually, I think it opens up a very interesting kind of discussion that I haven't really thought of, is how do people go about gaining these insights, and to what extent could you like program that, I guess? Because I think it's like romanticized in like movies or books that the character is going through some sort of crisis, and then it's almost like the equivalent of like falling in love or something like that, where they all of a sudden come across some piece of knowledge or something in their world kind of opens up to them and kind of tells them what's happening. And then their life changes, that they're able to like do all of these things. And I know that when I've went through stuff, I tend to like think in that way where it's like, oh, I saw like this little piece of graffiti that said this quote and I'm like going through this tough time and it's probably like relevant to me. And I think there is like a personality trait that and it's tied to our kind of cognitive attempts to like make sense and meaning out of things, that some people are just like more likely to try to find meaning in things. And it can sometimes lead to, I mean, at its worst, there's like schizotypal like behavior where you're like thinking that the TV's like talking to you and like everything, like all these billboards have meaning. But there is something kind of like where we're kind of looking out into the world for an answer. And I'm kind of a little bit curious how an intervention would do that, because that seems like not something that I have heard many like studies on. I haven't heard a lot of people talk about. I think it's maybe like an implicit assumption that I've made about how people like gain insight. Yeah, I wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, quick, first of all, I want to say that I am also interested in this like personality trait where people find meaning in mundane things. I think it's like what you're referring to is maybe aberrant salience, where and it's a trait that's like surprisingly normally distributed throughout the population, where people just kind of believe that things are magical or things have meaning even though they don't objectively have meaning. And I think that's really interesting, and I don't know, kind of speaks to this weird way that the human mind, they say, is like a meaning making machine. But anyways, that was like kind of off track. But so when it comes to making an intervention that tries to spark these insight moments, so people are already doing that with like psychedelic therapies. From my perspective, like when you try and give someone like a large dose of a psychedelic, the intention is to like give them a powerful experience that will shift, you know, how they think about everything. And it seems to, you know, have some promising effects. I don't actually know enough about the literature to even say promising effects, but it's interesting to me at least. So I guess that's kind of a similar perspective that I'm taking. Like, I don't want to give people psychedelics on the internet, but I kind of feel like you can have a, you know, mind-blowing experience. Even just so, like, if you look at YouTube comments on random videos, like videos of a concert from a band from the 80s, people will always comment something like, this, like, changed my life, this gave me strength to go on or something.
I think one of the most common comments I get on like my more personal videos is usually somebody saying that either YouTube is spying on them or they can't believe that this video came at the exact same time as this thing happened in their life, or it's like can't be a coincidence that this ended up in their like subscription box because this is exactly what they were thinking about. Like, it's like, and there's like enough of those comments, and like I'm just making these videos, I don't know what's going on in these people's lives, but yeah, it's like I don't know, it's really interesting how people are trying to find that sort of meaning in the world and how they really quickly like tie it to themselves and their sort of like journey through insight. Yeah,
I've totally noticed that on your videos, and felt that myself. I mean, have I actually mentioned that I am a Sisyphus 55 super fan? So, I mean, this is exciting for me as it is.
Oh, that means a lot. So, and regarding psychedelics, that is, I know in Canada, there's like, it's becoming a lot more, it used to be like a class A, like drug, like shrooms, like it was mixed with like up there with like cocaine as being highly illegal, and now they're using it for like clinical purposes, and that is, I didn't even think of that. That is probably, you hear about that all the time. I'm working on a video on, I don't know if you know the comedian George Carlin, but he's an example of somebody who, he was very kind of stuck in his ways early on in his career, and then he took acid, and then he realized all of these, like all this insight that, you know, usually it would take like some years of therapy to kind of get through. and he completely changed his comedy style, and he became this very like successful stand-up comedian that people referred to this day. And you hear stories like that, and yeah, it's really interesting how that seems to work when people dabble with those substances. And I guess for your purposes, it would be interesting to not so much like, how do I get my hand on these psychedelics to do this intervention properly? But what are these psychedelics doing exactly? What's that like motivational mechanism that is getting people to see these sort of like insights and kind of let go of their ego, as they would usually like use that language? Do you have any theories of that? Like what sort of motivates people into these insights?
Man, I don't even know how it works. I think it's still kind of mysterious. And I feel like the researchers that actually get into things like aha moments are like do tend to be into that kind of, you know, almost magical or like related to mindfulness realm, where you just try and understand like what is consciousness. And I think some of them have some like far out theories. Like I used to be in a lab, like after I graduated college, I was at UC Santa Barbara for a couple of years. And in my lab there, they were studying aha moments and inside experiences. And it did seem to have this overlap with like consciousness exploring type of people. But yeah, I don't know about mechanisms myself, but I think it's like clearly a, you know, powerful force. And I think it's maybe something that clinical psychology doesn't look into enough. Although, okay, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I don't really know. And my perspective has been from like, you know, courses taught by like researchers. But I feel like maybe there's such an emphasis put on understanding mechanisms of clinical change, like understanding like salience of social threat and, you know, neural processes like overactive amygdala, that maybe people aren't looking at these like bigger picture, less like physically mechanistic forces. I don't know.
Well, the fact that you mentioned that the first step of the intervention is based on like cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's kind of linked to like stoicism and mindfulness, and that seems to be a reoccurring thing, that these insights usually spring from people's ability to let go of kind of past and future anxieties and to like dedicate their attention to like the present, which makes sense, because if you focus on things in the present, which is usually when you imagine these aha moments happening, it's usually people being confronted by something in the present, like in some way that has some sort of symbolic importance. It's because they've like basically freed up, at least I think, they freed up some cognitive space. They're able to like dedicate their attention to the now. And once you do that, that definitely, like, it's not guaranteed, but I feel like it probably leads to, it might be one of the motivational mechanisms for this sort of change, is that sort of present awareness.
Okay, that is exactly why I emailed you. That's a great connection between the philosophy and like psychology worlds. So okay, maybe can I turn the question to you for a second? Like, more generally, do you think a lot about how those philosophical concepts impact mental health? And like, what are those mechanisms by which it might do so?
Yeah, I mean, if you really back up, when having a philosophical discussion of mental health, you kind of get into Kierkegaard's whole preoccupation and Otto Rank's preoccupation with what is healthy and what is normal, and like Artie Lang, and you can talk about like Deleuze and the anti-psychiatry movement, that the whole idea of health is a very cultural and very transient historical subject, that, you know, we right now we kind of have a general idea of what a healthy person is, but, you know, 30 40 years ago, a healthy person wasn't somebody who was gay. Like there's like an ever-changing kind of idea of what health means. So there's that, it's like constantly changing. But then there is, I think, this underlying stream throughout history. And you can see it with Aristotle, you can see it with like Buddhism, of this sort of preoccupation with the good life and like good living. And I do see a lot of the sort of philosophical advice and learnings from historical figures that didn't have any sort of access to empirical evidence, you see it come up again in these clinical studies, in these more scientific explorations. And I think that's really interesting, because you start looking at certain topics like love and well-being and stuff, and you realize how common these same questions come up again and again and again across cultures and history, and that there are certain running themes and maybe truths almost to these very obscure kind of confusing, ambivalent issues that everyone has to deal with throughout their lives. I 100% see a link between philosophy and issues of mental health. I think that philosophy in a lot of ways can answer questions that psychology isn't entirely capable of doing. And apologies for the construction sounds in the background.
No worries. I think I actually also have construction right outside my window.
Oh, that's great.
Those are great points. And interesting that, philosophers can say that mental health is always changing. Like, personally, I've been struggling over, maybe the past kind of, years to understand what even is mental health. Like, being that there are so many mental health initiatives on social media, on my college campus, in my department, I'm in this, group trying to work on well-being, in the undergrad and grad student population in my school, and I'm just constantly what is well-being, what is mental health, how do you support that for the most people, as opposed to just dealing with a specific mental health problem.
And it just reminds me of, and I think I've brought this up before with other people, but I feel like the most extreme version of the issues with trying to find the mentally healthy model is, there's that episode of SpongeBob where he really wants to become normal, and he becomes normal Bob, and he's just this he's no longer square, which is ironic, but he's a circular guy, and he doesn't have any of those sponge holes, and he's kind of creepy, and he doesn't really show any emotion other than this slight smile, and he completely loses it, because you can't function in a world being that normal, in a sense, you're not being yourself at all. And I don't know, I always just think of that whenever I think of going back to those generic mental health app kind of answers that don't really address the personal questions, that they do. They are kind of just created to generally create a normal functioning human being, which I don't know if that's actually what people want, beyond social expectations. But sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that was a great interruption and a great comparison. So I guess I agree, and that, people are so deep. There is this deepness to human life, and that cannot be ignored. But then at the same time, I also feel like it's sometimes useful to think of people as monkeys, where in order to have to have some basic level of well-being, you have to deal with the monkey concerns, getting food, getting good sleep, having a nice group of other monkeys to play around with, things like that. So that seems like it's the basis, and it's a little bit of a paradox that is the core of mental health, but there also are existential deep questions that we have to grapple with in order to be mentally healthy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's this kind of, there are certain fundamental, I believe this, there are certain fundamental, biological and psychological needs that need to be fulfilled. In the lab I worked in, it was, under self-determination theory, so they believed in, autonomy, relatedness, and competence as, the main three basic psychological needs for just general well-being. And, I think that's a fairly decent summary of it. But at the same time, it doesn't quite, it leaves a lot of questions unanswered. What would this sort of person look like? And there's almost this sort of yearning to know what the healthy person would be, someone who has all of these fulfilled. And what you find is when people, Maslow, he famously had kind of like a whole encyclopedia of people that were self-actualized. He had like, I think, Abraham Lincoln, Albert Einstein, and they're all very different personalities. They're all completely different people, and they all went along their own paths. And there is that sort of other component to it beyond just like the standardized model of health that is the, and I think this is maybe more important and probably more difficult to just create an intervention for. And I think it's maybe what you're trying to do is this personal health. Like, what would you look like at your, maybe not at your best, but happy or feeling good about yourself or satisfied in some way? And it also comes down to, I think, a common truth in philosophy, and it's like represented especially in like Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, which is you know, at one point the character comes across the Buddha and he has the option, he really wants to become enlightened, and he has the option to follow the Buddha, who's gaining some prominence in India, and he decides to go his own path. And by the end of the book, he does find enlightenment and he finds nirvana, and it's because of the fact that he eventually leaves the standardized model or the things that might have helped other people to answer his own questions and his own sort of mystery of existence. And that's like so much harder because a part of that's so fundamentally against the idea of science, because science is all about standards and generalized concepts and stuff like that. That's how it can function. It's like the messy human part of this question of what it means to like live a good life. That's my thoughts on it.
Yeah, totally. It's so tough. Like, how do you advise someone, like, or how would a clinician advise someone to go on like a personal quest to find meaning where there's nothing that can like guide them? It's such a like, yeah, such a strange problem. Like, I don't know. So are you still interested in doing clinical psychology yourself? Or like, how have you been grappling with that?
I have decided, at least for the next year, that I'm going to focus on the channel. And I am pretty happy with that decision. I definitely haven't like completely left the idea of going into academia, but I think just a mixture of sort of the state of the world right now and how uncertain it is when it comes to these like historically pretty stable institutions like academia, it does seem like talking to other people in grad school and teaching assistants and stuff that there's an insane amount of people that want to be professors, and there's a like minimized like shrinking number of people that like actually end up being professors, and there's not a lot of spaces open. And then also with clinical psychology, it's a very long path, and I'm not sure, I almost feel like I'm already satisfying that in some way by making these videos, because in sort of researching my own stuff and trying to figure out how I want to live, which is basically, these videos are the product of that, is me just kind of like trying to figure out my own sort of personal issues and then making videos on that, that it's helping a lot of other people, just from comments and emails, and that from a utilitarian point, it's maybe having more of an impact than if I dedicated a lot of my time with like a few clients, and that's after like 10, 20 years of working and finally opening up like a clinical practice. And so for right now, I'm pretty satisfied with where I am, but it's not to say that later on in the future I wouldn't pursue it, but I definitely don't see the rush just because of how fortunate I am like in my position right now.
I think you're totally right, and that actually brings us back to my like original question, is like, what actually is the impact of watching a Sisyphus 55 video on someone's life? Like, it has to be something, right? But like, so people like complain about getting like too wrapped up and just watching endless self-improvement videos on YouTube and never doing anything like that. That's a common experience. But at the same time, it's like so many people say these kinds of like informational YouTube videos or just being in an online community with, you know, hearing perspectives from different kinds of people are such meaningful experiences. And it's just that it's not being studied right now from a clinical perspective. But at the same time, it's kind of hard to study from a clinical perspective because, like, experimentally, you know, making someone watch like 5 of your videos, like that kind of makes sense, but maybe not for everybody. So that's what I'm trying to like get around by giving people a choice of the kind of content they want to consume and the intervention. But yeah, that's what I want to get at, is like what actually is the impact of watching your content. I don't know, like, do you want to do a study on it? Should we do a study on it?
That would be pretty interesting. I've definitely never been offered to be like a topic of a study or anything. And usually when people are, it's usually not under the best circumstances. But I guess on the point of like with like YouTube, it's and people like over consuming content to try to find an answer. I think that just goes back to a very old kind of piece of advice. I remember like Bertrand Russell's a huge proponent of this. It's like there's a certain point where you need to just stop reading and you have to start doing these things. Like you can't just you can't live your whole life just constantly on this quest of knowledge and stuff. Like there has to be some like application, which is kind of following from like the American pragmatist like school of thought. There's no use to just constantly consuming content, and I think that might be the sort of it's the danger of, I think, using social media to alleviate mental health problems, is that people can start kind of leaning on it too much as kind of a coping mechanism, and they get that kind of false sense of, because I'm watching, I do this, I watch all these productivity videos, so I'm kind of productive now, but I don't actually have to be productive. It's the equivalent of like late in the evening where you're like your self-control resources are completely sapped, but then you start writing down all the things that you're gonna do. It's kind of like you're kind of giving yourself that idea that you're like doing something, but you're not really doing something. Yeah, like that's, I think that's a little bit of the, it's a potential threat to it. And I see a lot of people use it. And I think it's just like a crutch, like anything else. And some people are more susceptible to it than others. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know how useful it is. I think it's useful if people watch, I'll just let these trucks go by. Oh my. Yeah, like I think that, I think that it's only as useful if people are actually like actively using the videos, and it's almost like another level of motivation. It seems like a lot of people are motivated to learn stuff and to improve themselves in some sense, but there's this kind of action step that seems to be the most difficult. In therapy, in just a lot of like especially like addiction programs, like going from like recognizing the issue and then actually doing something about it, that's really hard to make that jump.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've been like maybe digging into the literature on behavior change more and more, and it's like such a tricky subject. There's so many theories trying to figure out how do you do behavior change right, how do you motivate people, because it's just like not our natural state in a lot of ways. But yeah, what you brought up like brings up another issue, which is that of like having evidence for like the online content, because so much of it is not evidence-based. Like, you know, people like you are smart and you're making, you know, in intelligent content, but it's not necessarily like proven to work, you know, in the way that it's intended, or even based on like evidence-based theory. So that's a real challenge, but like I think even still, that's not like a huge or like necessarily deal-breaking challenge, because where was I going with this? Because yeah, so like it could still work, but yeah, so it's just something to think about. But then something else that I thought about is just that there are these like communities that try and motivate people online in ways that can be weird. So something that really like stuck out to me was I used to browse 4chan when I was like, I don't know, 16, 17. And on the fitness forum, there was always this like sub like thread called like Self-Improvement General, where people posted these beautiful little like images that were made by users that, so some of them were like motivational, you know, and some of them were actual guides to like, this is how you sleep better, this is how you read more books, this is how you, you know, gain physical strength, this is how you become more focused or have better well-being. And I thought it was beautiful because it was like personalized for that actual community. So it's like not coming from an external, you know, expert, it's coming from other people like you who have that lived experience. But then, so the flip side of those threads is that there's just hella Nazis on it, which is just like, which is so weird. And I don't know, you know what to make of that. So maybe that's like where I see my single session interventions fitting in. It's creating some kind of like evidence-based support system that includes that like kind of platform or community-specific feeling, but it's like actually science-backed stuff, and you're not gonna have to deal with Nazis trying to recruit you.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think that also it the political kind of bleeds into it a little bit. There was a recent video I did on Byung-Chul Han's psychopolitics, and he makes the argument that the way the kind of neoliberal structures work is that we see ourselves as these projects that are always, that we always need to be constantly working on. And if we just get it right, then we'll like be like happy and we'll be like free. And the issue with this is that we'll never be able to feel like fulfilled. And it actually creates what he thinks is kind of like almost a class struggle within ourselves, where we become the thing that's trying to make profit, and then we also become the thing that like is like wants to enjoy the profit. So we become both like master and slave, and that, you know, an old sort of Marxist critiques, it was he'd see those as two separate classes. There'd be the elites trying to profit off of like the lower class, like the proletariat, and this would lead to a class struggle through anger, and then that would lead to a revolution. But Byung-Chul Han's argument is that because this class struggle is internal, the anger is not anger projected outwards, it's anger projected inwards in the form of depression. And that's his sort of idea of like mental health issues, in a way, is that we are extremely hard on ourselves, and when we do poorly, we blame it on ourselves. And I think you see with conservative movements and conservative thinkers and how the self-improvement motivational community kind of goes towards that, you can see why they kind of support that argument. Like, I'm thinking of like Gary Vee and stuff like that, where it's your fault and you need to be suffering in order to be free. And it's not the world's fault. The world just, you just have to accept that the world is that bad, and you shouldn't be trying to change the world. You have to change yourself. And that's where I can I can see the toxic element to the self-improvement videos. And I think I also started noticing, I follow a lot of these productivity channels, and I started seeing in the last few years, the more level-headed ones, they started kind of talking about the fact that productivity is not this thing that you should keep doing. Like, this will kind of start burning you out. You start kind of wondering why you're doing this to begin with, because you're never actually able to, like, live at all. And so it's even if, like, we're talking about that jump in behavior from motivation to action, but sometimes it's like, even if you make that jump, is it like the right motivation, or is this like a motivation coming from this sort of this anger within yourself that you're always trying to like better yourself? And I with my videos, I especially the last year or so, I've tried to be a lot more conscious of addressing that and trying to not tell people like, you need to go out there and you need to do this and that, and like everybody should take it a little bit easier and just, you know, we're here for a short amount of time. And just, yeah, don't be so hard on yourself. I think that's a fairly succinct idea about like the mental health crisis that has zero scientific support, but I think it makes sense, at least from my end.
I love that. Yeah. I don't think it has zero support. I'm sure someone is studying that. Yeah, that's great. I have no further comment on that, but that's great.
Yeah, and I guess on your end, the one, because we're almost at an hour, which is crazy. I feel like we could talk about this stuff for a while. But how do you conceive of loneliness? Do you see it as always a bad thing? Do you see it as sometimes having some form of benefits? And I'm kind of just curious, has it like increased in recent years, or has it always been kind of a fundamental part of human nature?
Okay, yeah, let's dig in. Now I can flex. I've been reading on this stuff forever to write my proposal. Okay, so loneliness, the definition is like emotional pain caused by perceived social isolation. So it's not like the objective amount of people around you, like how many friends you have. It's the feeling that you're alone. And it's kind of weird that we have this feeling and it's so like prevalent. Like everyone experiences loneliness all the time. And like people can have a, you know, greater tendency towards loneliness than other people. Like just genetically, they're predisposed to feel it more. But yeah, so maybe I can talk about like why does loneliness exist. And the one theory is like this evolutionary theory of loneliness, which is that basically social relationships, like interpersonal relationships, are super fundamental to what it means to be a human. Like back in the day, in our environment of evolutionary adaptiveness, you know, or like just nature and people, if you are alone against nature, that's like a super risk. Like you're probably gonna die pretty quick. And it, you know, still remains the fact, like if I went out into the woods, I would not last long. But you know, the way that humans just work, if we are in a group, we just do so much better. We just tend to dominate our environments. So, you know, based on that fact, we've evolved all of these psychological, you know, just parts of our mind that make social relationships really important. So we're super attuned, always looking out, like, how are our relationships going? And so loneliness functions as this warning signal to warn us that we might be at risk of, like, losing our high-quality social relationships and getting cut off from our social group, which, of course, has bearing on our, like, abilities to survive. Or it did in our environment of ecological or evolutionary adaptiveness. Today it's not so clear, right? Like if you know, I'm living alone in an apartment, I'm probably gonna be okay. There's like Trader Joe's pretty close. I don't actually necessarily need other people around me to survive, but it's still part of my mind where I of course feel so much better when I have friends around and I'm like on good terms with my family. So we have to look out for that. So this is like that difference between loneliness and solitude that we talked about a little bit over email, where there are clearly positive elements of solitude. Like when you're alone, you have the time to think through your life and like grow and rest and learn new stuff and come up with brilliant ideas. Like I love solitude, you know, I'm sure you love solitude too. So there are positives to it, but there are also such positives towards like being together. And it's, you know, even if you want to, you know, embrace solitude, I think you really can't take it too far, because if you spend too much time alone, at a certain point, it's like you're going to kind of start to lose a little bit or just feel lonely. It's a little bit unavoidable. That solitude will turn into loneliness. Okay, so that's what I think about loneliness. Let me like cover prevalence a little bit. So there are a couple of narratives about the prevalence of loneliness. One is that people are getting more and more lonely over time, especially people say like maybe over the past 50 years since life is more like independent, people are more career focused, people are living alone more. People say based on that, people should be feeling more lonely. It doesn't really come out. Like if you look at like surveys where they ask people over the past 50 years, how lonely do you feel pretty much? You don't see like increasing numbers over time. That being said, it is very prevalent. Like loneliness is much more prevalent than like other mental disorders, really, even though it's not really a mental disorder, unless it's like chronic and severe. But yeah, there are different estimates because depending on the way that you like define or measure loneliness, it varies. But I think one example is like they asked people in like 2000 something, like how much or do you feel that loneliness is a major cause of suffering in your life? And it's like over 50% of Americans said yes to that.
Wow.
So yeah. And that way it's prevalent, but it's important to consider when you hear these people talking about like, there's a loneliness epidemic, it's getting worse, like life is getting more lonely. There doesn't really seem to be a large scale increase. Okay, the other narrative is that social media is causing loneliness. And we kind of like talked about that a little bit. And that one has like, it's still being debated, but like once again, there is not a strong argument at this point based on the data that we have that loneliness is caused by like social media use. Yeah, so that's basically what I know about loneliness. Do you have any questions?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I guess like the one question that is relevant and could maybe help wrap this all up is how do you deal with loneliness? Like, do you feel that there are certain mechanisms that are like healthy that you could use and other people could try to use, especially when it seems like loneliness is such a serious, relevant issue right now?
Yeah, there are a couple of meta-analyses looking at this question. Meta-analysis meaning that you just look at a bunch of studies, like 100 different studies that on people that have run interventions, like experiments testing what is the best way to deal with loneliness. And there are a couple of techniques that emerge as useful. One is social skills training, where you like train yourself to be better at communicating with people. You know, you just like try and make eye contact more, smile more, and really make an effort to like go out into social situations. That seems to be helpful. Another one is dealing with like negative social cognitions. So this is where you use a method like cognitive behavioral therapy, where you try and challenge your thoughts that have to do with like negative beliefs about like socializing. So for example, you might think, if I go to this party, everyone's gonna think I'm weird, or like I'm just not a interesting person, people just don't like me. So challenging those thoughts is another way to go about it. I think there's some like debate as to which of those methods is like the most useful. I talked to this one researcher who has been working on like internet interventions for loneliness, and he's insisted to me that based on his like research, taking a really active approach to loneliness is the best, meaning like actually set plans with everybody you know to try and hang out and just try and do as many social things. So even though probably some of those social experiences are going to be negative and you're actually going to show up and it's going to be awkward, like that's just how social life is, some of those will be positive and it's going to help you to disprove these beliefs that you've developed over time that have made you more and more lonely. Like the way that loneliness works is that there's this sort of negative cycle of beliefs about yourself, like I'm not cool, beliefs about other people, which might be that people are like selfish, it's not possible to have a like good relationship or friendship these days. So those like create a cycle where you tend to believe negative thoughts and engage in more avoidant behaviors, like avoiding social situations. Yeah.
That's a lot of information. That's definitely useful stuff to know. We're at the hour. Yeah, sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so there was one other thing that we mentioned over email that I feel like I didn't bring up, which is like the philosophical perspective on loneliness, which I'm so into, and I feel like it's not talked about much in like clinical psych circles, which is to like in some way embrace solitude. We talked about it a little bit before, but like this is what all of the philosophers say since like Montaigne in whatever, 15 whatever, and probably before that. They basically say the ability to like withstand solitude and to embrace the time that you have alone is of real value. Like, try not to freak out when you might feel lonely. Know that that loneliness, okay, maybe it was risky 100,000 years ago, but it's probably not going to kill you. So there are things to embrace about doing stuff alone. Okay, that was the last note that I want to have.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point, and I think that's a good way to sum up like a lot of, I mean, philosophers, I think if you did a personality profile of most of them, they're usually pretty introverted, and they did not like other people a lot because they usually felt like they were misunderstood. And there is like a little bit of, I almost feel like a like kind of a bias when it comes to philosophy in general. But I think that it still is very good advice, not so much as be a hermit and don't, you know, talk to anybody, but try to be okay with being alone with yourself first, because then your social interactions will be a lot more meaningful. They're going to be a lot more in the moment, like we were talking about. They're going to be you'll be more focused on other people because you'll be more settled with yourself, and you're not going to be, you know, reliant on those sort of cognitions you were talking about that involve self-worth and, you know, the fact that your self-esteem is contingent upon other people's evaluation of your social performance and how you're doing, and if this is an awkward situation, if you're saying the right things. It's like once you're okay with yourself, you kind of have a sort of stable core, and you can go out in the world and you can interact, and you're going to end up with better social interactions. And yeah, it's a little bit, I was just thinking about just overall this whole discussion. I, now that I live alone in this apartment, and I know other friends I have, they do the same thing. They live alone. They, basically the day, if they're not working, is just drifting between, they'll go on like YouTube, they're going to watch TV, they'll have like a podcast playing while they're like cooking, they'll have music playing in the shower. There's like this underlying phobia of silence and having to like be alone with your thoughts. And then I live close to this park, and there's this old man that just every day he just goes and sits at that park for like an hour. And I don't know what he's doing. He's not listening to music. He's not even like feeding ducks or anything, but he's just like being alone with himself. And it's, I think that that's a little bit of like a, I don't know, sounding like kind of an old person here, but it's a bit of generational advice in that, you know, it's, for much of human history, people were able to be alone without any noise or anything. And I think that that helped them be more comfortable with solitude and maybe deal with loneliness a little bit better. And it probably led to more like meaningful interactions also. But yeah, that's all I would say.
Yeah, I think you're right. But then I also think like if you are feeling lonely, you have to be a little bit brave about it and like reach out. Like I've seen people that, you know, thought they're weird forever, and suddenly like I'm thinking of one person in my life who is just like making these social moves, and everyone is just watching him turn into a social butterfly and loving to see it after being like, you know, shy for a long time. And maybe he's a little bit like, you know, I don't know what it looks like with his new friends. If he's super cool all of a sudden, but I mean, he's making new friends, and I love to see it. And that takes bravery, and it takes some effort. So I want to like say that that's like has to be part of it. Like the social stuff is not easy, but it's worth it if you put in the effort.
It takes a lot of courage, for sure. Yeah, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I don't know. I want to thank you. Like, I want to say I was nervous about this. I thought I was going to be weird. I thought I was going to be super parasocial. But this has been cool. It's been a really fun talk, and I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, yeah. No, it was my pleasure. Like, this was incredibly informative. I definitely learned a lot. I felt like it was a pretty natural discussion. Sorry about all the background noise, yeah, thank you for coming on, telling us a little bit about what you're doing, and best of luck with the intervention.
Thanks so much. And I am going to email you more about my study idea, because it's starting to grow in my brain.
Okay, yeah, of course. No, I'm definitely interested. All right.
Okay, cool.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks so much, man. Bye.